The room was definitely a man's room, with books and models of the fighter planes Johnny Baker had flown, and a Skylab with broken wings, and a large framed poster of a bulky suited man crawling in space along one of those wings, a faceless, alien shape, disconnected from the spacecraft, risking the loneliest death ever if he let go for even an instant. The NASA medal hung from below the picture. Mementos of times past, but only the past. There were no pictures of the shuttle, delayed once more. No reminders of the Pentagon, Johnny's present assignment. Two pictures of the children, one with Anne in the background, short, browned, competent Anne, who already had a look of puzzled unhappiness in the photo. His hand was wrapped around the glass, but he had forgotten glass and hand. Maureen could watch his face without his knowing it. Johnny Baker saw only the screen. Parabolic orbits diagrammed against the concentric circular paths of the planets. Old photos of Halley's Comet and Brooks's Comet and Cunningham's Comet and others, culminating in a blurred pinpoint that was Hamner Brown. A man with large insectile glasses lectured with fierce intensity. "Oh, we'll get hit someday. It probably won't be an asteroid either. The orbits are too nearly fixed. There must have been asteroids whose orbits intersected Earth's, but those have had 4 billion years to hit us, and most of them eventually did," said the lecturer. "They hit so long ago that even the craters are gone, weathered away, except for the biggest and the newest. But look at the moon. The comets are different." The lecturer's pointer traced a parabola drawn in chalk. "Some mass way out there beyond Pluto, maybe an undiscovered planet. We even have a name for it. Persephone. Some mass disturbs the orbit of these great snowballs, and they come down on our heads in a wake of boiling chemicals. None of them have ever had a chance to hit the Earth until they get thrown down into the inner system. One day we'll be hit. We'd have about a year's warning. Maybe more, if we can learn enough about Hamner Brown." Then an antiseptic young woman proclaimed that she wasn't married to her house, and was told that that was why Calva Soap had invented a new disinfectant for her toilet bowl. And Johnny Baker came smiling back into the world. "He really makes his points, doesn't he?"
"It is well done. Did I tell you I met the man who put it together? I met Tim Hamner, too. At the same party with Harvey Randall. Hamner's a case. Manic. He'd just discovered his comet and couldn't wait to tell everyone."
Johnny Baker sipped his drink. Then, after a long pause, he said, "Some funny rumors in the Pentagon."
"Oh?"
"Gus called, from Downey. Seems Rockwell's refurbishing an Apollo, and there's some mutters about diverting one of the Titan boosters from a big bird to something else. Know anything?" She sipped her drink and felt a wave of sadness. Now she knew why Johnny Baker had called her yesterday. After 6 weeks in the Pentagon, 6 weeks in Washington with no attempt to see her, and then... And I was going to surprise him. Some surprise.
"Dad's trying to get Congress to fund a comet study mission," Maureen said.
"This for real?" Johnny demanded.
"It's for real."
"But..."
His hands were shaking. His hands never shook. John Baker had flown fighters over Hanoi, and his maneuvers were always perfect. The MiGs never had a chance, and once he'd taken splinters out of his crew chief when there wasn't time to get the medics. There was a splinter in the chief's chest, and Baker had removed it and sliced deftly to expose the artery, clamped it together with steady fingers while the chief screamed, and the Kong mortars thudded onto the field. And his hands had never shaken. But they were shaking now.
"Congress won't put up the money."
"They might. The Russians are planning a mission."
"Can't let them outdo us," Maureen said.
"Peace depends on showing them we're still willing to compete, if that's the way they want it. And if we compete, we win."
"I don't care if it's Martians we're competing with. I've got to go. I've got to."
He drained his scotch. His hands were suddenly steady. Maureen watched in fascination. "He stopped shaking because he's got a mission. And I know what it is. me. To get me to get him on that ship. A minute ago, he might really have been in love with me. Not now. I'm sorry, he said abruptly. We don't have all that much time together, and I'm laying this on you, but you had me dead to rights. My mind doesn't turn off. He drank deeply of his ice-diluted scotch. His attention went back to the screen and left Maureen wondering if she'd been imagining things. Just how clever was John Baker? The commercial mercifully ended, and the camera zoomed in on the Jet Propulsion Laboratories. Harry Newcomb hastily chewed the last of his sandwich while he drove the mail truck with one hand. The regulations gave him time off for lunch, but Harry never took it. He used the time for better purposes. It was long past noon when he got to Silver Valley Ranch. As usual, he stopped at the gate. There was a spot where he could look through a pass in the foothills to the majesty of the High Sierra to the east. Snow gleamed off their tops. To the west were more foothills, the sun not too far above them. Finally, he got out to open the gate, drove through, and carefully closed the gate behind him. He ignored the large mailbox on its post beside the gate. He stopped along the drive to pick a pomegranate from the grove that had started as one tree and was still, untended, propagating itself downhill toward the stream. Harry had seen it grow in the half-year he'd been on the route, and was guessing when the pomegranates would roll all the way downhill into the cocklebur patch. Would they choke out the burrs? He had no idea, really. Harry was a city boy. Harry was an ex-city boy. Ha! And if he never saw a city again, he'd be happy. He was grinning as he shouldered his load and walked lopsided to the door. Rang, set the bag down. The dimly heard hurricane of a vacuum cleaner calmed. Mrs. Cox opened the door and smiled at the bulging bag beside Harry.
That day again? Hello, Harry.
Hi. A happy trash day, Mrs. Cox.
And a happy trash day to you, too, Harry. Coffee?
Don't stay me. It's against government regulations.
Fresh coffee and new-baked rolls.
Well, I can't resist that.
He reached into the smaller pouch that still hung at his side.
A letter from your sister in Idaho, and something from the senator.
He handed her the letters, then shouldered the bag and wobbled in.
Any place special?
The dining table's big enough.
Harry spilled the contents of the larger bag across a polished table of lovely grain. It seemed to have been carved out of a slice of a single tree, and must have been 50 years old. They didn't make tables like that anymore. If there was furniture like that in the caretaker's home, what must it be like in the big house up the hill? The wood grain was hidden under a deluge, begging letters from charities, from several political parties, from colleges, offers to join lotteries by buying records, clothing, books, subscriptions to magazines. You may already have won $100 a week for life. Religious tracts, political lessons, single tax literature, free samples of soap, mouthwash, detergent, deodorant. Alice Cox brought in the coffee. She was only 11, but she was already beautiful. Long blonde hair, blue eyes. A trusting girl, as Harry knew from seeing her when he was off duty. But she could be trusting here. Nobody was going to bother her. Most of the men in Silver Valley kept rifles slung on racks in their pickups, and they damned well knew what to do with anybody who'd bother an 11-year-old girl. It was one of the things Harry liked about the Valley, not the threat of violence, because Harry hated violence, but that it was only a threat. The rifles came off their racks only for deer, in season or out, if the ranchers were hungry or the deer got into the crops. Mrs. Cox brought in rolls. Half the people on Harry's route offered him coffee and eats on days when he ignored regulations and brought the mail up to their houses. Mrs. Cox didn't make the best coffee on the route, but the cup was definitely the finest in the valley. Thin-bone china, much too good for a half-hippie mailman. The first time Harry had been to the house, he'd drunk water from a tin cup and stood at the door. Now he sat at the fine table and drank coffee from bone china. Another reason to stay out of cities. He sipped hurriedly, There was another blonde girl, this one over 18 and legal, and it would be trash day for her house, too. She'd be home. Donna Adams was always home for Harry.
"Lot here for the senator," Harry said.
"Yes, he's back in Washington," Mrs. Cox answered.
"But he's coming soon,"
Alice piped.
"Wish he'd hurry," Mrs. Cox said. "It's nice here when the senator's in residence. People coming and going. Important people. The president stayed at the big house one night. Secret Service made a big fuss. Men wandering all over the ranch."
She laughed, and Alice giggled. Harry looked puzzled.
"As if anybody in this valley would harm the President of the United States," Mrs. Cox said.
"I still think your Senator Jellison's a myth," Harry said. "I've been on this route 8 months, and I haven't seen him yet."
Mrs. Cox looked him up and down. He seemed a nice enough boy, although Mrs. Adams said her daughter paid him entirely too much attention. Harry's long, flowing, curly brown hair would have looked good on a girl. His beard was beautiful. The real masterpiece was the mustache. It came to long points, which, on formal occasions, Harry could curl and wax into circles like small spectacles.
"He can grow hair," Mrs. Cox thought, "but he's little and skinny, not as big as I am."
She wondered again what Donna Adams saw in him.
Car, maybe.
Harry had a sports car, and all the local boys drove pickups like their fathers.
"You'll likely meet the senator soon enough," Mrs. Cox said. It was a sign of ultimate approval, although Harry didn't know that. Mrs. Cox was very careful about who the senator met.
Alice had been sifting through the mound of multicolored paper on the table.
"Lot of it this time. How much is this?"
2 weeks, Harry said.
"Well, we do thank you, Harry," Mrs. Cox said.
"So do I,"
Alice added.
"If you didn't bring it up to the house, I'd have to carry all of it."
Back in the truck and down the long drive, with another stop to look at the High Sierra. Then on to the next ranch, a good half mile away. The senator kept a big spread, although a lot of it was dry pasture, shot through with ground squirrel holes. It was good land, but there wasn't enough water to irrigate it. At the next gate, George Christopher was doing something incomprehensible in the orange groves. Probably setting up to smudge, Harry decided. Christopher came plodding up as Harry opened the gate. He was a bull of a man, Harry's height and 2 or 3 times Harry's width, with a thick neck. His head was bald and tanned, but Christopher couldn't be a lot over 30. He wore a checkered flannel shirt and dark trousers, muddy boots. Harry set the bag down and got out beside it. Christopher frowned.
"Trash day again, Harry."
He studied the long hair and extravagantly trimmed beard, and the frown deepened. Harry grinned in return.
"Yep, happy trash day. Every 2 weeks, like clockwork. I'll take it up to the house for you."
"You don't have to."
"I like to."
There wasn't a Mrs. Christopher, but George had a sister about Alice Cox's age, and she liked to talk to Harry. A very bright little girl, pleasant to talk to, and full of news about Harry's valley.
"All right, mind the dog."
"Sure will."
Harry never worried about dogs.
"Ever wonder what the advertising industry would give for your head?"
Christopher asked.
"I'll trade him question for question," Harry said. "Why does the government give them a lower rate so they can waste more of our time and your taxes?"
Christopher's frown faded, and he almost smiled.
"Have at 'em, Harry. Lost causes are the only ones worth fighting for. And the taxpayers' cause is about as lost as they come. I'll close the gate behind you."
Day's end, clock-out time. Harry went into the sorting rooms behind the post office. There was a note pinned to his station. "Harry, the wolf wants to see you. Gina, XXX." Gina, tall, black, erect of posture and large of bone, the only black in the valley as far as Harry knew, was at the counter. Harry winked at her, then knocked at the supervisor's door. When he entered, Mr. Wolf regarded him coldly.
"Harry, happy trash day," Wolf said.
"Oops," but Harry smiled.
"Thank you, and happy trash day to you, sir."
"Not funny, Harry. Why do you do it?" Why do you separate out the commercial mail and reserve it for one day every 2 weeks?
Harry shrugged. He could have explained. Sorting junk mail took so much of his time that he didn't have a chance to chat with his customers, so he'd started letting it pile up. It had begun that way, but it had become popular with his people. "Everybody's happy with it," Harry said defensively. "People can go through the stuff or just drop it in the fireplace."
"It is illegal to withhold a citizen's mail," Wolf said.
"If someone has complained, I'll take him off the list," Harry said. "I like to keep my customers happy."
"Mrs. Adams," Wolf said.
"Oh, too bad. Without Trash Day, he wouldn't have an excuse to go up to the Adams house and talk to Donna."
"You will deliver the commercial mail according to regulations," Wolf was saying. "As it comes in, not in batches. Trash Day will cease."
"Yes, sir. Any other way I can be obliging?"
"Shave your beard. Cut your hair."
Harry shook his head. That part of the regulations he knew. Wolf sighed.
"Harry, you just don't have the right attitude to be a mailman."
Eileen Susan Hancock's office was small and cramped, but it was an office. She had worked for years to get an office of her own, away from the area behind the counter. It proved that she was more than a secretary. She was poking at the buttons on her calculator, frowning, when a sudden thought made her burst into rippling laughter. A moment later, she realized that Joe Corrigan was standing in her doorway. Corrigan came into the office. He had unbuttoned the top button of his trousers again, and it showed. His wife wouldn't let him buy larger sizes. She hadn't given up hope that he would reduce. He put his thumbs into the waistband and regarded her quizzically. Eileen's laughter cut off. She went back to the calculator, and now she wasn't even smiling.
"Okay," Corrigan said. "What's the punchline?"
Eileen looked up with wide eyes. "What? Oh, no, I couldn't possibly tell you."
"If you drive me nuts, you think you can gain control of the company, right?"
"Because it won't work. I've covered that." Corrigan liked to see her like this. Eileen was all or nothing, very serious and hard at work, or enjoying herself to the full.
"Okay," Corrigan sighed. "I'll give away my secret for yours. I've had the decorators in. You see, Robin Geston signed up for the marina deal."
"Oh, that's good."
"Yep, means we'll need more help. As of the first, you're assistant general manager, if you want the job."
"Oh, I want it. Thank you."
She smiled flickeringly, like a flashbulb, on and off almost before you saw it, and turned back to the desk calculator. "I knew you would. That's why I had the decorators in. They're turning that room next to mine into a new office for you. I've told them to consult you after they do the preliminaries." Corrigan lowered his weight onto the corner of her desk. "There, I was keeping it for a surprise. Now what's your secret?"
"I've forgotten," Eileen said. "And I do have to get these estimates done so you can take them to Bakersfield with you."
"Okay," Corrigan said. He went back to his office, defeated.
If he knew, Eileen thought. She had an urge to giggle, but she held it back. She wasn't really trying to tease Corrigan. She had been thinking, well, I did it. And Robin was nice, not the world's greatest lover, but he didn't pretend to be, either. The way he'd suggested a rematch, lovers need practice, he'd said. The second time is always better than the first. They'd left it vague. Maybe, just maybe, she'd take him up on it sometime, but probably not. He'd also told her definitely that he was married. She'd only suspected it before. Never had there been any suggestion that business had anything to do with their private lives, but he'd signed up with Corrigan's Plumbing Supplies for a very large deal. And she felt funny about that, and wondered if she'd have been as careless about finding out Robin's marital status if the deal hadn't been pending. But he'd signed up. So here she was, adding up numbers, pushing papers around, and suddenly she'd asked herself, what does this have to do with plumbing? I don't make pipe, I don't lay pipe, I don't ream it out or tell people where to put it. What I do is push paper around. It was an important job. Measure it by the chaos she could create with one random mistake or one malicious error. Thousands of tons of supplies might be sent to the ends of the earth by a slip of her pen. But what she did had no more to do with creation, with making the things that held a civilization together, than income tax, or being the fireman on a diesel train. Mr. Corrigan would probably spend the whole day wondering why she'd suddenly burst into sparkling laughter, and there was no way she could tell him. It had just come to her, unexpected and irresistible. What she had done with Robin Geston on the night before last was the closest she had ever come to any activity actually connected with plumbing. The car wouldn't be reported stolen for hours. Alim Nassor was pretty sure of that, sure enough that he would sit in it for another 10 minutes. Alim Nassor had been a great man. When he had made himself great again, he would have to hide what he was doing now. Before he was great, he had been George Washington Carver Davis. His mother had been proud of that name. She'd said the family was named for Jefferson Davis. That honky had been a tough dude, but it was a loser's name, no power in it. He'd had a lot of street names since. His mother hadn't liked those. When she threw him out, he took his own. Alim Nassor meant wise conqueror in both Arabic and Swahili. Not many knew what it meant, and so what. The name had power. Alim Nassor had a hell of a lot more power than George Washington Carver ever did. You could read about Alim Nassor in the newspapers, and he could still walk into City Hall and get in to see people. He'd been able to do that ever since he broke up a riot with his switchblade and the razor blades in his shoes and the chain he carried around his waist. There was all that federal money around for a tough dude. The honkies shoveled out money. Anything for quiet in the black ghetto. It had been a damn good game, and too bad it was over. He cursed quietly. Mayor Bentley Allen. Los Angeles had itself another black mayor, and this goddamn Tom had cut off the pipeline. New people in city council, and that stupid son of a bitch of a black congressman who couldn't be satisfied with the take. No, that asshole had to put all his relatives on the community payroll, and the fucking TV reporters found out. A black man in politics needed a snow-white rep these days. Well, the game was over, and he'd started another. 11 jobs, each one worked fine. They'd taken, what, $250,000 in loot in 4 years? Less than $100,000 after the fences went through it. $20,000 each for 4 men in 4 years. That wasn't even wages. Easy to say now that some of it should have been stashed for lawyers' fees, but at $5,000 a year. This would be the 13th. It wouldn't be long now. The store did a lot of business. Alim waited, always aware of the time. 2 customers left, and nobody was coming down the street. He wasn't happy about this job. He didn't like ripping off blood. Honkies were fair game, but you ought to leave brothers alone. He'd hammered that into his followers' heads, and what were they thinking of him now? But he was boxed in. He had to act fast. The place was ripe, and he'd been saving it for an emergency, and this was one shitpot motherfucker of an emergency. His honky lawyer would probably beat this for him, but lawyers and bondsmen wanted bread, and now. It was crazy, robbing a store to pay a lawyer to get him off for robbing a store. Someday things would be different. Alim Nassor would make them different. Almost time. 2 minutes ago, one of his brothers had got himself stopped for a traffic violation 14 blocks away, and that took 1 pigmobile off patrol. 20 minutes ago, another brother had a family argument, and the sister called the station house, and there went the other fuzz wagon. There'd be only the 2. Black areas didn't get patrolled the way honky business districts did. Blacks didn't have big insurance policies or know how to kiss ass down at City Hall. Sometimes he used as many as 4 diversions, with traffic jams thrown in. They only took spreading some bread among the kids to get them playing in the streets. Alim Nassor was a natural leader. He hadn't been busted since juvenile days, except for that last one where an off-duty cop had come out of a laundromat. Who'd have thought that brother was a pig? He still wondered if he should have shot it out. Anyway, he hadn't. He'd run into an alley and ditched the gun and the mask and the bag. Lawyers could take care of those. The only other evidence was the honky storekeeper's identification, and there were ways to talk him out of testifying. Time. Alim got out of the car. The mask looked like a face. From 10 feet away, you wouldn't know it was a mask at all. The gun was under his windbreaker. Windbreaker and mask would be gone 5 minutes after the job. Alim's mind closed down, shutting out past and future. He walked across at an intersection. No jaywalking, nothing to attract attention. The store was empty. It went down nice, no problems. He had the money, and was on the way out when the brother came in. A man Alim had known for years. What was that bastard doing over in this part of town? Nobody from Boyle Heights ought to be here, below Watts. Aw, shit. But that brother knew. Maybe from his walk, maybe anything. Shit, he knew. It took him a second to make up his mind. Then Alim turned, aimed, and fired. A second shot, to be certain. The man went down, and the old storekeeper's eyes were big with horror. And Alim fired 3 times more. One more robbery wouldn't have upset anyone, but the pigs worked hard on murder. Best leave no witnesses. Too bad, though. He came out fast and didn't go to the stolen car across the street. Instead, he walked a fast half block, went through an alleyway, and came out on another street. His arm still tingled with that unique, atavistic thrill. Man was made to use a club, and a gun is the ultimate in clubs. Point and make a fist, and if the enemy is close enough to see his face, one blow will knock him over dead. Power. Alim knew people who had got hooked on that sensation. His brother, mother's son, not just blood, waited for him in a car that wasn't hot. They drove off just at the speed limit, fast enough not to attract attention, slow enough not to get busted.
Had to waste 2, Alim said. Harold winced, but his voice was cool.
Too bad. Who were they?
Nobody. Nobody important.
March 2. Most astronomers envisage comets as forming a vast cloud surrounding the solar system and stretching perhaps halfway to the nearest star. The Dutch astronomer J. H. Oort, after whom the cloud is usually named, has estimated that the cloud contains perhaps 100 billion comets. Brian Marsden, Smithsonian Institution. They loaded them up well in the green room. 2 ushers and an astonishingly pretty hostess poured their glasses full as soon as they were half empty, so that Tim Hamner had drunk more than he liked. At that, he thought, I'm well off compared to Arnold. Arnold was a best-selling writer, and Arnold never talked about anything that wasn't in his books. When Tim told him Hamner Brown was now visible to the naked eye, Arnold didn't know what Tim was talking about. When Tim told him, Arnold wanted to meet Brown. One of the ushers signaled, and Tim got unsteadily to his feet. The stairs hadn't seemed so steep when he came down them. He arrived on stage to hear the last of Johnny's smoothly professional monologue, and to bask in the audience applause. Johnny was in full form, joking with the other guests. Tim remembered from the monitor downstairs that Sharps of JPL had been giving a lecture on comets, and that Johnny seemed to know a great deal about astronomy. The other guest, a dowager whose breast equipment had 20 years ago given a new word to the English language, kept interrupting with off-color jokes. The dowager was quite drunk. Tim remembered that her name was Mary Jane, and that no one ever called her by her stage name anymore. At her age and weight, it would have been ridiculous. The opening chatter got Tim through a terrible moment of stage fright. Then Johnny turned to him and asked,
"How do you discover a comet? I wish I'd done that."
He seemed quite serious. "You wouldn't have time," Tim said. "It takes years, decades sometimes, and no guarantees, ever. You pick a telescope, and you memorize the sky through it, and then you spend every night looking at nothing, and freezing your can off. It gets cold in that mountain observatory." Mary Jane said something. Johnny was alarmed, but didn't show it. The sound man with his earphones gave Johnny a high sign.
"Do you like owning a comet?"
Johnny asked.
"Half a comet," Tim said automatically. "I love it."
"He won't own it long," Dr. Sharps said.
"Eh? How's that?"
Tim demanded.
"It'll be the Russians who own it," Sharps said. "They're sending up a Soyuz to have a close look from space. When they get through, it will be their comet."
That was appalling. Tim asked,
"But can't we do something?"
"Sure, we can put up an Apollo or something bigger. We've got the equipment sitting around getting rusty. We even did the preliminary work, but the money has run out."
"But you could put something up," Johnny asked, "if you had the money."
"We could be up there watching Earth go through the tail. It's a shame the American people don't care more about technology. Nobody cares a hang as long as their electric carving knives work. You ever stop to think just how dependent we are on things that none of us understand?"
Sharps gestured dramatically around the TV studio. Johnny started to say something about the housewife who ran a home computer as a hobby and changed his mind. The studio audience was listening. There was a careful silence that Johnny had long since learned to respect. They wanted to hear Sharps. Maybe this would be one of the good nights, one of the shows that ran over and over, Sundays, anniversaries.
"Not just the TV," Sharps was saying. "Your desk, Formica top. What is Formica? Anyone know how it's made, or how to make a pencil? Much less penicillin. Our lives depend on these things, and none of us knows much about them. Not even me."
"I always wondered what makes bra straps snappy," Mary Jane said.
Johnny jumped in to give the show back to Sharps.
"But tell me, Charlie, what good will it do to study that comet? How will that change our lives?"
Sharps shrugged.
"It may not. You're asking what good new research does, and all I can answer is that it always has paid off. Not the way you thought it would, maybe. Who'd have thought we'd get a whole new medical technology out of the space program? But we did. Thousands are alive right now because the human factors boys had to develop new instruments for the astronauts. Johnny, did you ever hear of the Club of Rome?"
Johnny had, but the audience would need reminding.
"They were the people who did computer simulations to find out how long we could get along on our natural resources, even with zero population growth."
"They tell us we're finished," Sharps broke in, "and that's stupid. We're only finished because they won't let us really use technology. They say we're running out of metals. There's more metal in one little asteroid than was mined all over the world in the last 5 years, and there are hundreds of thousands of asteroids. All we have to do is go get them."
"Can we?"
"You bet. Even with the technology we already have, we could do it. Johnny, out there in space it's raining soup, and we don't even know about soup bowls."
The studio audience applauded. They hadn't been cued by the production assistants, but they applauded. Johnny gave Sharps an approving smile and decided how the program would go for the rest of the night. But first, there was a frantic signal, time for a Calva soap commercial. There was more after the commercial. When Sharps got going, he was really dynamic. His thin, bony hands waved around like windmills. He talked about windmills, too, and about how much power the sun put out every day, about the solar flare Skylab's crew had observed. "Johnny, there was enough power in that one little flare to run our whole civilization for hundreds of years, and those idiots talk about doom." But they were neglecting Tim Hamner, and Johnny had to bring him into the conversation. Hamner was sitting there nodding, obviously enjoying Sharps. Johnny carefully maneuvered the scientist back onto the comet, then saw his chance.
"Charlie, you said the Russians would get a close look at Hamner Brown. How close?" "Pretty close. We'll definitely pass through the tail of the comet. I showed you why we can't tell how close the head will come, but it's going to be very close. If we're lucky, maybe as close as the moon."
"I wouldn't call that luck," Mary Jane said.
"Tim, it's your comet," Johnny said. "Could Hamner Brown actually hit us?"
"That's Hamner Brown," Tim said.
"Oh," Johnny laughed. "What did I say? Hammer?
It would be a hammer if it hit, wouldn't it?"
"You know it," Charlie Sharps said.
"Just what would it do?" Johnny asked.
Well, we've got some pretty big holes left from meteor strikes, Tim said. Meteor crater in Arizona is nearly a mile wide. Vredevoort in South Africa is so big you can't see it except from the air. And those were the little ones, Sharps said. They all turned to look at him. Sharps grinned. Ever notice how circular Hudson's Bay looks, or the Sea of Japan?
Were those meteors? Johnny asked.
The thought was horrifying.
A lot of us think so, and something pretty big cracked the moon wide open. A quarter of its surface is covered by that so-called ocean, which was once a sea of lava welling up from where a big asteroid hit.
Of course, we don't know what Hamner Brown is made of, Tim said.
Maybe it's time we found these things out, Mary Jane said, before one of them does hit us, like this one.
It's only a matter of time, Sharps said. Give it long enough, and the probability of a comet hitting us approaches certainty. But I don't think we have to worry about Hamner Brown.
Henry Armitage was a TV preacher. He'd been a radio preacher until one of his converts left him $10 million. Now he had his own slick paper magazine, TV shows in 100 cities, and an elaborate complex of buildings in Pasadena, complete with editorial staff. For all that, Henry wrote much of the magazine himself, and he always did the editorials. There were too few hours in the day for Henry. He gloried in the troubles of the world. He knew what they meant. They were the signs of a greater joy to come. For the disciples had asked the Master, "Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming, and of the end of the world?" And Jesus answered and said unto them, "Take heed that no man shall deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many." Henry had seen the entry on the Inyo County, California police blotter, "Charles Manson, also known as Jesus Christ, God." "And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in divers places." Matthew was Henry's favorite gospel, and of all the Bible, that was his favorite text. Were these not the times Christ spoke of? The signs were all present in the world. He sat at his expensive desk. The TV was concealed behind a panel that opened when Henry touched a button. It was a long way from the wood-frame, whitewashed one-room church in Idaho where Henry had started in the 30s. The ostentatious wealth sometimes disturbed Henry, but his supporters insisted on it, even if Henry and his wife would have been as happy in plainer surroundings. Henry toyed with his editorial, but he didn't feel inspired. As a lesson in humility, he had the TV turned to an interview show. The lesson was to watch that shallow frivolity without hating those who took part in it, and that was hard, hard. Something caught his attention. A thin, tall man in a herringbone sport jacket, arms waving about. Henry admired his technique. The man would make an impressive preacher. He focused all attention on himself, and his words washed across the listener. The man was talking about a comet. A comet. A sign in the heavens. Henry knew what comets were, but because comets were natural did not mean that their timing was not miraculous. Henry had seen many healed by prayer, and the doctors later explained the miracle. A comet, and it would pass very close to Earth. Could this be the final sign of all? He drew a yellow-lined tablet toward him and began writing in sloppy block print using 12 pencils. He was through 3 sheets before he knew his headline, and he turned back to the first page. In 2 weeks, his magazine would be in 500,000 homes around the world, and across the cover, in blazing red 20-point type, would be his headline, "The Hammer of God." It would make a good text for his TV shows, too. Henry began writing frantically, feeling the way he had felt nearly 40 years before, when he'd really begun to understand Matthew 24. And had carried the message to a world that didn't care. "The hammer of God was coming to punish the decadent and the willful," Henry wrote eagerly. April 1. From the fury of the Norsemen, spare us, good Lord. From the great comet, good Lord, deliver us. Medieval Litany. Tim Hamner arrived in a taxi just as Harvey's travel-all reached JPL. As Tim handed the driver a 20 and waved him away, Harvey swore. Then he put on his best face as Tim came over to join him. Hamner looked sheepish.
"Look, Harvey, I said I wouldn't interfere, and I won't. But I met Sharps on that interview show."
"Yeah, I saw that," Harvey said. "Sharps was great."
"He sure was," Hamner said. "I want to meet him again. I called JPL, and they said you were coming here for an interview. Harvey, I want to come along."
Inwardly, Harvey felt anger, but it was a reasonable request from a sponsor. "Sure." Charlene, the PR lady, was waiting, and she didn't make any fuss about Tim Hamner's unexpected appearance with the crew. Sharps' office hadn't changed. There were different books scattered around the expensive desk, and instead of an IBM printout, there was a large diagram. The cast changes, Harvey thought, but the play's the same. "What ho!" Sharps said. He lifted a brow at Hamner. "Sponsor come along to check on you. Harvey, I hope this won't take long. I'm due in the lab shortly." Harvey waved to the crew. Charlie was already setting up, and Mark moved around with the light meter. Mark had become pretty good at this job, and he'd stayed around longer than Harvey could remember him keeping a job before. If he left, Harvey would miss him. "We're interested in the probe," Harvey said. "Does it look as if it will really go?" Sharps smiled broadly. "Looks good, looks good. Thanks to Senator Arthur Jellison. Remember our conversation about that?"
"Right."
"Well, he's the man. I'd appreciate any good publicity you can give him." Harvey nodded. He signaled to the crew. "Let's run it." "Speed," Manuel said. Charlie was behind the camera. Mark stepped out with the board. "Sharps interview, take one." Clack. "Dr. Sharps," Harvey said, "there's been some criticism of the proposed Apollo mission to study the comet. It's said it will be too dangerous." Sharps made a gesture of dismissal. "Dangerous? We've done it all before. A tried-and-true booster and a proven capsule. Not so many months of planning as NASA likes, but ask the men who'll fly it. Ask the astronauts if they think it's too dangerous."
"Has the crew been chosen yet?"
"No, but there are 40 volunteers." Sharps grinned at the camera. Harvey went on with his questions. They talked about the instruments the Apollo would carry. Many of them were being put together at JPL and at Caltech. "Students and technicians working overtime without pay," Sharps said, "just to help out."
"Without pay?" Harvey asked.
"Right. They get their regular work done, the things we have contracts for, and then put in overtime on comet packages, without pay."
That ought to go well, Harvey thought.
He made a note to interview some of the technicians. Maybe he could find a janitor who worked overtime to help.
"It sounds like you can't carry enough gear," Harvey said.
"Well, we really can't," Sharps agreed. "Not all we'd like to carry. But what's enough? We can take up enough to learn a lot."
"Right. Dr. Sharps, I understand you've done a new plot of Hamner Brown's orbit, and you've got new photos of it."
"Hale Observatories has the photos. We did the orbit. We're safe in saying it will be a big comet. It's got the largest coma ever recorded for this distance from the sun. That means there's a lot of ice left in the snowball, and it's going to come quite close. First it will pass at a reasonable distance, and we'll see a spectacular tail. Then it goes inside the orbit of Venus, and most of it will vanish, although some of the tail may be visible for a while. Naked eye visible, I might add. After that, it will be too close to the sun for us to see from here. But, of course, the Apollo crew will be able to get good observations from space. We won't see it again until it gets very near Earth on its way back out. By then, the sky should be filled with the tail. I'm willing to bet that tail will be visible in daytime."
Mark Chescu whistled. Manuel didn't glitch, so Harvey knew it hadn't got onto the tape. Harvey felt like whistling himself.
The office door opened. In came a short, rounded, vague man, about 30 years old. He had a trimmed dark beard and thick glasses. He wore a green Pendleton wool shirt, and both pockets bristled with pens and pencils of every imaginable color and nib. A pocket computer hung at his belt.
"Oh, sorry, I thought you were alone."
His voice was apologetic. He began to back out.
"No, no, stay and hear this," Sharp said. "Let me introduce Dr. Dan Forrester. His job title is computer programmer. His degrees say Ph.D. in astronomy. Around here, we usually call him our sane genius."
Mark was muttering behind Harvey.
"If they call him a genius in this outfit..."
Harvey nodded. He'd thought of that, too.
"Dan's been doing more recasts of Hamner Brown's orbit. He's also working on the optimum launch date for our Apollo, given the limited amount of equipment we can take, and the limited amount of consumables."
"Consumables?" Harvey asked.
"Food, water, air. They take mass. We can only put up so much mass, and so we trade consumables for instruments. But consumables mean time in orbit, so Dan's working on the problem. Is it better to launch earlier with less equipment, so they can stay longer, but get less information?"
"Not information," Forrester said. His voice was apologetic. "Sorry to interrupt."
"No, tell us what you mean," Harvey said.
"We're trying to maximize information," Forrester said. "So the problem is, do we get more information by having more data about a shorter time, or less data about a longer time?"
"Oh," Harvey nodded.
"So what have you got on Hamner Brown? How far away at its closest point?"
"Zero,"
Forrester said. He didn't crack a smile.
You mean it's coming down our throats?"
"I doubt it."
Now he smiled.
"Zero within the limits of prediction, which is a good 500,000 miles error."
Harvey relaxed. So he noticed did everyone in the room, including Charlene. They took Forrester seriously here. He turned to Sharps.
"Tell us, what would happen if the comet did hit us? Suppose we got unlucky."
"You mean the head, the nucleus? Because it looks as if we might actually pass through the outer coma, which is nothing more than gas."
"No, I mean the head. What happens? The end of the world?"
"Oh, no, nothing like that. Probably the end of civilization." There was silence in the room for a moment, then for another.
"But," Harvey said, his voice puzzled, "Dr. Sharps, you told me that a comet, even the head, is largely foamy ice with rocks in it, and even the ice is frozen gases. That doesn't sound dangerous."
"In fact," Harvey thought, "I asked to get it on the record."
"Several heads," Dan Forrester said. "At least it looks that way. I think it's beginning to calve already, and if it does it now, it will do it later. Probably. Maybe."
"So it's even less dangerous," Harvey said.
Sharps wasn't listening to Harvey. He rolled his eyes toward the ceiling.
"Calving already?"
Forrester's grin widened.
"Ook, ook."
Then he noticed Harvey Randall again.
"You asked about danger," he said. "Let's look at it. We have several masses, largely the same material that boils off to form the coma and the tail. Fine dust, foamy frozen gases with pockets where the really volatile stuff has been long gone, and maybe a few rocks embedded in there. Hey,"
Randall looked up at Forrester. Forrester was grinning his cherubic smile.
"That's probably why it's so bright already. Some of the gases are interacting. Think what we'll see when they really get to boiling near the sun. Ook, ook."
Sharps was getting that thoughtful, lost look again. Harvey said quickly,
"Dr. Sharps, yes, certainly. What happens if it hits, which it won't?"
"Well, what makes the nucleus dangerous is that it's big, and it's coming fast. Enormous energies."
"Because of the rocks?" Harvey asked. Rocks he could understand.
"How big are those rocks?"
"Not very," Forrester said. "But that's theory."
"Right." Sharps was aware of the camera again.
"That's why we need the probe. We don't know. But I'd guess the rocks are small, from the size of a baseball to the size of a small hill."
Harvey felt relief. That couldn't be dangerous. A small hill.
"But of course that doesn't matter," Sharps said. "They'll be embedded in the frozen gases and water ice.
It would all hit as several solid masses, not as a lot of little chunks.
Harvey paused to think that over. This film would take careful editing.
It still doesn't sound dangerous. Even nickel-iron meteors usually burn out long before they hit the ground. In fact, in all history, there's only been one recorded case of anyone being harmed by a meteor.
Sure, that lady in Alabama, Forrester said. It got her picture in Life. Wow, that was the biggest bruise I ever saw.
Wasn't there a lawsuit?
Her landlady said it was her meteor because it ended up in her basement.
Harvey said, look, Hamner Brown will hit atmosphere a lot harder than any normal meteorite, and it's mostly ice. The masses will burn faster, won't they?
He saw two shaking heads, a thin face wearing insectile glasses, and a thick bushy beard above thick glasses. And over against the wall, Mark was shaking his head, too. Sharp said, they'd bore through quicker. When the mass is above a certain size, it stops being important whether Earth has an atmosphere or not.
Except to us, Forrester said, deadpan.
Sharps paused a second, then laughed. Politely, Harvey thought, but it was done carefully. Sharps took pains to avoid offending Forrester.
What we need is a good analogy.
Sharps's brow furrowed.
Hot fudge sundae, said Forrester.
Huh?
Forrester's grin was wide through his beard.
A cubic mile of hot fudge sundae. Cometary speeds.
Sharps's eyes lit up.
I like it. Let's hit Earth with a cubic mile of hot fudge sundae.
Lord God, they've gone bonkers, Harvey thought. The two men raced each other to the blackboard. Sharps began to draw.
Okay, hot fudge sundae. Let's see. We'll put the vanilla ice cream in the center, with a layer of fudge over it.
He ignored the strangled sound behind him. Tim Hamner hadn't said a word during the whole interview. Now he was doubled over, holding himself, trying to hold in the laughter. He looked up, choked, got his face straight, said,
I can't stand it,
and brayed like a jackass.
My comet! A cubic mile of hot fudge sundae.
With the fudge as the outer shell, Forrester amplified. So the fudge will heat up when the hammer rounds the sun.
That's Hamner Brown, Tim said, straight-faced. No, my child, that's a cubic mile of hot fudge sundae, and the ice cream will still be frozen inside the shell, said Sharps.
Harvey said, but you forgot the...
We put the cherry at one pole, and say that pole was in shadow at perihelion.
Sharps sketched to show that when the comet rounded the sun, the cherry at the oblate spheroid's axis would be on the side away from Sol.
We don't want it scorched, and we'll put crushed nuts all through it to represent rocks. Say, a 200-foot cherry.
Carried by the Royal Canadian Air Force, Mark said.
Stan Freeberg, right,
Forrester whooped.
Shh! Plop! Let's see you do that on television.
And now, as the comet rounds the sun, trailing a luminous froth of fake whipped cream, and aims itself down our throats, Dan, what's the density of vanilla ice cream?
Forrester shrugged.
It floats, say 2/3.
Right, 0.666 it is.
Sharps seized a pocket calculator from the desk and punched frantically.
I love these things. Used to use slide rules. Never could figure out where the decimal point went.
A cubic mile to play with. 5,280 feet times 12 for inches times 2.54 for centimeters. Cube that. We have 2.776 times 10 to the 15th cubic centimeters of vanilla ice cream. It would take a while to eat it all, times the density, and lo, we have about 2 × 10⁻⁵ grams, couple of billion tons. Now for the fudge, Sharps punched away. Happy as a clam, Harvey thought, a very voluble clam equipped with Texas Instruments' latest pocket marvel.
What do you like for the density of hot fudge? Sharps asked.
Call it 0.9. Forrester said.
Haven't any of you made fudge? Charlene demanded. It doesn't float.
You test it by dripping it in a cup of cold water. Or at least my mother did.
Say 1.2, then, Forrester said.
Another 1.5 billion tons of hot fudge, Sharps said. Behind him, Hamner made more strangled noises.
I think we can ignore the rocks, Sharps said. Do you see why now?
Lord God, yes, Harvey said. He looked at the camera with a start.
Yes, Dr. Sharps, it certainly makes sense to ignore the rocks.
You're not going to show this, are you?
Tim Hamner sounded indignant.
You're saying no, Harvey asked.
No, no, Hamner doubled over and giggled.
Now she's coming at cometary speeds, fast. Let's see, parabolic speed at Earth orbit is what, Dan?
29.7 kilometers per second, times square root of 2.
42 kilometers a second, Sharps announced. And we've got Earth's orbital velocity to add. Depends on the geometry of the strike. Shall we say 50 kilometers a second as a reasonable closing velocity?
Sounds good, Forrester said. Meteors go from 20 to maybe 70. It's reasonable.
Right, call it 50. Square that, times a half, times mass in grams. Bit over 2 times 10 to the 28 ergs. That's for the vanilla ice cream. Now we can figure that most of the hot fudge boiled away. But understand, Harvey, at those speeds, we're just not in the atmosphere very long. If we come in straight, it's 2 seconds flat. Anyway, whatever mass you burn up, a lot of the energy just gets transferred to the Earth's heat balance. That's a spectacular explosion all by itself. We'll figure 20% of the hot fudge energy transfers to Earth, and...
More buttons pressed and a dramatic rise in voice.
Our grand total is 2.7 times 10 to the 28th ergs. Okay, that's your strike.
Doesn't mean much to me, Harvey said. It sounds like a big number.
One followed by 28 zeros, Mark muttered.
640,000 megatons, near enough,
Dan Forrester said gently.
It is a big number.
Good God, pasteurized planet, Mark said.
Not quite.
Forrester had his own calculator out of the belt case.
About 3,000 Krakatoas, or 300 Thera explosions, if they're right about Thera.
Thera? Harvey asked.
Volcano in the Mediterranean, Mark said. Bronze Age, where the Atlantis legend comes from.
Your friend's right, Sharps said. I'm not sure about the energy, though. Look at it this way. All of mankind uses about 10 to the 29th ergs in a year. That's everything. Electric power, coal, nuclear energy, burning buffalo chips, cars, you name it. So our hot fudge sundae pops in with about 30% of the world's annual energy budget.
Not so bad then, Harvey said.
Not so bad. Not so bad as what? A year's energy in 1 minute... Sharps said. It probably hits water. If it hits land, it's tough for anyone under it, but most of the energy radiates back out to space fairly quickly. But if it hits water, it vaporizes it. Let's see, ergs to calories.
Damn, I don't have that on my gadget.
I do, Forrester said. The strike would vaporize about 60 million cubic kilometers of water. Or 50 billion acre feet, if you like that. Enough to cover the entire USA with 212 feet of water.
All right, Sharps said. So 60 million cubic kilometers of water go into the atmosphere. Harvey, it's going to rain. A lot of that water is moving across polar areas. It freezes, falls as snow. Glaciers form fast. Slide south. Yeah. Harvey, the historians believe the Thera explosion changed the world's climate. We know that Tambora, about as powerful as Krakatoa, caused what historians of the last century called the year without a summer. Famine, crop failure. Our hot fudge sundae will probably trigger an ice age. All those clouds. Clouds reflect heat. Less sunlight gets to Earth. Snow reflects heat, too. Still less sunlight. It gets colder. More snow falls. Glaciers move south because they don't melt as fast.
positive feedback. It had all turned dead serious. Harvey asked, "But what stops ice ages?" Forrester and Sharp shrugged in unison.
"So," Hamner said, "my comet's going to bring about an ice age."
Now you could see the long, lugubrious face of his grandfather, who could look bereaved at a $60,000 funeral. Forrester said, "No, that was Hot Fudge Sunday we were talking about. The hammer is bigger."
Hamner Brown. "How much bigger?"
Forrester made an uncertain gesture.
10 times?
"Yes," said Harvey. There were pictures in his mind. Glaciers marched south across fields and forests, across vegetation already killed by snow, down across North America into California, across Europe to the Alps and Pyrenees. Winter after winter, each colder than the great freeze of 76-77. And hell, they hadn't even mentioned the tidal waves. "But a comet won't be as dense as a cubic mile of... It was just one of those things. Harvey leaned back in his chair and belly laughed, because there was just no way he could say it. Later, he made his own tape, alone, in a studio approximation of an office. Fake books on the shelves, worn carpet on the floor. Here he could talk. "Sorry about that." This would run just after one of Harvey's breakups. He'd done that several times in the Sharps interview. "The points to remember are these. First, the odds against any solid part of Hamner Brown hitting us are literally astronomical. Over these distances, even the devil himself couldn't hit a target as small as Earth. Second, if it did hit, it would probably be as several large masses. Some of those would hit ocean. Others would hit land, where the damage would be local. But if Hamner Brown did strike the Earth, it would be as if the devil had struck with an enormous hammer, repeatedly." April. Interludes. 50,000 years ago in Arizona. Friction with the air makes the surface incandescent as the oxygen in the atmosphere blowtorches the iron. From this great flying mass, sputtering chunks as large as houses fly off as the meteoroid, traveling at a low angle, nears the ground. A huge cylinder of superheated air is forced along by the meteoroid, and as it strikes, this air is forced across the surrounding countryside in a fiery blast that instantaneously scorches every living thing for 100 miles in every direction. Frank W. Lane, The Elements' Rage, Chilton, 1965. Leonila Malik scribbled a prescription and handed it to her patient. He was the last for the morning, and when the man had left her examining room, Leonila took the bottle of Grand Marnier from her lower desk drawer and poured a small, precious glass. The expensive liqueur was a present from one of her fellow cosmonauts, and drinking it gave her a delicious feeling of decadence. Her friend also brought her silk hose and a slip from Paris. "And I've never been outside Russia," she thought. She let the sweet fluid roll over her tongue. "No matter how I try, they will never let me go." She wondered what her status was. Her father had been a physician with a fairly good reputation among the Kremlin elite. Then had come the doctor's plot, an insane Stalinist delusion that the Kremlin physicians were trying to poison the revolutionary leader of our times, hero of the people, teacher and inspired leader of the world proletariat, Comrade Joseph Vissarionovich Stalin. Her father and 40 other doctors had vanished into the Lubyanka. One of her father's legacies was a 1950 copy of Pravda. He had carefully underlined every mention of Stalin's name, 91 times on the front page alone, 10 times as great leader and 6 as great Stalin. He should have poisoned the bastard, Leonila thought. It wasn't a pleasant concept. There was a long tradition about that. The oath of Hippocrates wasn't taught in Soviet medical schools, but she had read it. As the daughter of an enemy of the people, Leonila's future hadn't seemed very bright. But then had come a new era, and Dr. Malik was rehabilitated. By way of reparations, Leonila had been rescued from secretarial work in an obscure Ukrainian town and sent to the university. A liaison with an Air Force colonel had resulted in her learning to fly, and from that, weirdly, to her ambiguous status in the Cosmonaut Corps. The colonel was now a general and long since married, but he continued to help her. She had never been in space. She had been trained for it, but she had never been chosen. Instead, she treated flyers and their dependents, and got in flying time when she could, and hoped for a lucky break. There was a tap at the door. Sergeant Breslov, a young man of no more than 19 years, proud to be a sergeant in the Red Army. Only, of course, it wasn't the Red Army anymore, and hadn't been since Stalin had been forced to rename it during what he had to call the Great Patriotic War. Breslov would have preferred the Red Army. He often talked of carrying freedom across the world on the point of his bayonet. "There is a long message for you, Comrade Captain. You have been transferred to Baikunyar." He frowned at the bottle which Leonila had forgotten to put away. "Back to work," Leonila said. "That is worth celebration. Will you join me?" She poured a glass for Breslov. He drank, standing at stiff attention. It was one way of showing disapproval of officers who drank before lunch. Of course, many of them did, which to Breslov was another indication of how things had gone downhill since the Red Army days his father boasted of. In 3 hours, she was flying toward the spaceport. She could hardly believe it. Urgency orders, authorizing her to fly a jet trainer, her belongings to be sent after her. What could be so important? She pushed the question from her mind and reveled in the joy of flying. Alone in the clear skies, no one looking over her shoulder, no other pilots eager for their chance at the stick. Ecstasy. Only one thing could be better. Could that be why they'd sent for her? She knew of no space missions. But perhaps. "I've been lucky for a long time. Why not more luck?" She imagined being in a real Soyuz, waiting for the big boosters to roar and fling the spacecraft up into clean space. And for the hell of it, she flipped the jet trainer into a series of aerobatics that would have got her grounded if anyone had been watching. A sudden gust across the San Joaquin Valley shook the trailer slightly, bringing Barry Price to instant wakefulness. He lay still, listening for the reassuring sound of the bulldozers. His crews were still at work on the nuclear power plant. There was light outside. He sat up carefully to avoid waking Dolores, but she stirred and opened one eye. "What time is it?" she asked, her voice heavy with sleep.
"About 6.
"Oh, my God. Come back to bed," she reached for him. The covers fell away, revealing her tanned breasts. He moved away, avoiding her, then caught her hands in one of his and held them while he bent to kiss her.
"Woman, you're insatiable."
"I haven't had any complaints yet. Are you really getting up?"
"Yes, I've got engineering work to do, and we've got visitors later, and I've got to read that memo McCleave sent over yesterday. Should have got to it last night."
She grinned muzzily.
"Bet what we did was more fun. Sure you won't come back to bed?"
"No." He went to the sink and ran water until it was hot.
"You wake up faster than any man I've ever known," Dolores said. "I'm not getting up at the crack of dawn."
She pulled the pillow over her head, but she continued to move slightly under the covers, letting him know she was awake. Still available, Barry thought.
Yo-ho, then why am I putting on my pants?
When he was dressed, he pretended to think she was asleep and quickly left the trailer. Outside, he stretched in the morning sunshine, breathing deeply. His trailer was at the edge of the camp that housed much of the San Joaquin Nuclear Project workforce. Dolores had one far away, but she didn't use it often these days. Barry walked toward the plant with a grin that faded as he thought about Dolores. She was wonderful, and what they did in their copious free time hadn't affected their work at all. She was more administrative assistant than secretary, and he knew damned well he couldn't get along without her.
She was at least as important to his work as the operations manager, and that terrified Barry Price. He kept waiting for the possessiveness, the not unreasonable demands for his time and attention that had made life with Grace so unpleasant. He couldn't believe that Dolores would remain satisfied simply to be his... What, he wondered. Mistress wasn't right. He didn't support her. The idea was funny. Dolores wasn't about to let any man have that kind of control over her life. Make it lover, he thought, and enjoy it and be glad. He stopped to get coffee from the big urn at the construction supervisor's shack. They always had excellent coffee. He carried a cup up to his office and took out McCleave's memo. A minute later, he was screaming in anger. He hadn't calmed down when Dolores arrived about 8:30. She came in with more coffee to find him pacing the office. "What's the matter?" she asked. "Another thing I love about her," Barry thought. "She never demands anything personal at the office." "This," he lifted the memo. "Do you know what those idiots want?"